Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Let me tell you right off the bat, this is going to be a bit of an unusual episode for us here at This Day in Miami History, because I'm telling you immediately that, as far as I can tell, nothing of significance related to the topic of the episode today actually occurred on this day in Miami history. So why am I talking? Because the topic that I chose for this month's episode was the foundation of Burger King in Miami-Dade County. And multiple reputable sources of information indicate that Burger King in Miami-Dade County opened its doors for the first time on December 4th, 1954. But that's definitely wrong. Now, those of you who are familiar with fast food history know that Burger King, while it comes to be known and associated with Miami-Dade County, was actually started in Jacksonville. And that's a whole other problem as well, because multiple sources say that the first Burger King in Jacksonville, which was known as Instant Burger King, opened its doors in July of 1954. But I know for a fact that the first Burger King restaurant in Jacksonville opened in 1953. Burger King itself, with remarkably little fanfare, actually acknowledged what it says is its anniversary on June 1st of this year, saying that Burger King was founded 70 years before in Miami, Florida in 1954. But again, that's not quite true either, because we know the restaurants in Jacksonville, and I know for a fact that a Burger King restaurant opened in Miami months before that. How do I know that? Because the co-founder of Burger King of Miami, the corporate entity that would become the Burger King that we all know, wrote a book. That book and that man will be the subject of our episode today. Whether or not December 4th, 1954 has any particular significance to Burger King and Miami-Dade County, because the story is worth telling and knowing. Today, this day in Miami history, December 4th, 2024, a day in which I will talk to the son and grandson of James McLemore, the co-founder of Burger King and one of Miami-Dade County's greatest philanthropists. The high times and low times, all in the night life. Now, before we get into the interview, I want to be clear about what we do know of the timeline. So I'm going to lay out everything we have so you can be as informed as possible. First, we know that what would become the first Instant Burger King, that was at that point known as Instant Burger, was being built in Jacksonville in the summer of 1953 and likely open in the fall or winter of that year. David Edgerton Jr., who visited the restaurant in the summer of 1953 as it was under construction, decided to pick up an option to franchise the restaurant in Miami-Dade County. The very first Burger King in Miami-Dade County would open on March 1st, 1954 at 3090 Northwest 36th Street in Miami. At some point in the summer of 1954, Burger King claims June 1st. Dave Edgerton met with James McLemore, who had a restaurant in Brickell that was already successful, the Brickell Bridge Restaurant. The reason why I'm a bit skeptical of the June 1st, 1954 date is we know when the partnership of Edgerton and McLemore is officially organized, and that's August 11th, 1954. Thanks to their corporate filing with the Florida Department of State. You can actually look on SunBiz and find that corporate listing filed August 11th, 1954. and made inactive May 31st, 1972, when the Burger King Corporation of Miami merges with Pillsbury. So those are the key dates that we find. Might there have been a Burger King opening on December 4th? And maybe was that the first one that opened after the partnership with David Edgerton and James McLemore? It's possible. I can't find any evidence of that. I will let you know that I have a contact into, an email and a phone call into Burger King's global media headquarters, and I am awaiting response, but I didn't want to delay the episode because, by gosh, we have everything else ready to roll. I will update this episode and update on social media if I get a further response from Burger King. But what I can tell you, as you have already heard, this thing is a little bit confusing because you have multiple people, multiple parts, multiple pieces of this franchise business ultimately coming together. But what's most important are these two men at the center, David Edgerton Jr. and James McLemore. And McLemore ultimately becomes most closely associated with Burger King, as well as closely associated with important cultural and educational institutions in Miami-Dade County, particularly Fairchild Tropical Gardens and the University of Miami, a university in which he served as the chairman of the Board of Trustees. I reached out late last month to speak to his son and grandson, Whit McLemore, his son, and Sterling McLemore, his grandson. I was able to spend some time with them and talk a little bit about their father and grandfather, about his experience in Miami, why Miami was so important to him, and ultimately what made him a captain of industry and philanthropy. And what attracted me to the conversation was the book, The Burger King, that was written by James McLemore shortly before his death and reissued by Mango Publishing with the assistance of the McLemore Family Foundation in 2020. I will encourage you, after listening to this episode, to find this book, to buy this book, to read this book. It's a great read, it's a quick read, and it's incredibly informative about one of the most important business leaders in the history of Miami-Dade County. So, without further ado, here's my conversation with Whit and Sterling McLemore. All righty, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon or this morning or whenever you may be listening to us out there on the podcast feed. I'm really honored to be joined today by two men with an incredible knowledge of one of the most important figures in the history of Miami-Dade. And that is James McLemore, the co-founder of Burger King of Miami, which became Burger King. So I'm joined by Whit and Sterling McLemore. Gentlemen, how are you doing this morning?
Very good, thank you.
Doing great, thank you.
Glad to hear it. So Whit, I'm going to start with you a little bit because you were very much involved in some of the early stages of the business. And then Sterling, I'm going to fold you in to talk a little bit about the McLemore Family Foundation. And I'll tell you what kind of prompted this interest of mine in talking to you was the re-release by the Family Foundation of James McLemore's autobiography, The Burger King, which is one of the best named autobiographies I think I've ever seen. It's pretty great. So, Whit, your father wrote in his autobiography about his whole life, not just his corporate life, which I think makes it a lot more interesting. And he spoke in particular over and over and over again about his love for his wife, Nancy, and her hometown of Miami. James was not a Miamian by birth. Nancy was. And it was an invitation to the holidays by Nancy that kind of brought him down to Miami for the first time. He writes a little bit in the book about kind of the experience of being in the tropics in Miami. But what else do you think he saw in Miami at that time that ultimately would draw him back down here?
Well, I think the interesting thing to note is he was born and raised in New York, right outside of New York City in Central Valley. Basically lived his whole life in the Northeast and until he met my mother. She was from Miami and he was a young college man at Cornell, met her there. And she invited him to come down to Miami for Christmas. His family was, his mother had passed and his father remarried and his mother, stepmother he wasn't really fond of. So he took her up on the invitation to come down to Miami for Christmas. Well, he didn't have any money, so he put on his Navy uniform and hitchhiked down to Miami for the holiday. You gotta understand, it was pretty cold up in Ithaca, New York at the time, but as he got down towards North Carolina, it warmed up a bit. And he happened to hitch a ride with the guy carrying a Chris Craft boat down to Miami. And he, along the way, he said, "Hey, do you mind if I go up top and ride in the boat while we drive down the road?" So he's loving Florida at this point because it was freezing cold, snowing in Ithaca, and he gets down to Florida and he's up there in the top of this boat, just dreaming the dream, you know. So I think that's why he liked it so much. He got down there, the weather was great, her family was great, the people were great. He got to go with her to the bath club. Her parents were members of the bath club on Miami Beach. So they enjoyed, you know, sailing around a little sailboat and having a good time. And that's why I think he fell in love with Miami at that point.
Yeah, as a I was born and raised in Baltimore and moved down here to attend the University of Miami. And that first winter, after finals, just went to the beach, Crandon Park, and I'm like, I don't have to leave this. You know, there's nothing mandating. And I really sympathize with your father, like connected with him in that passage. I'm like, wait, there's another way to live life, you know? So I thought that was fascinating. And I think his story is there are 100,000 other James McLemore stories like that, just coming to Miami and never being able to leave. So you mentioned that he was coming from Ithaca. He attended university at Cornell, and kind of talks about how he kind of whipped his way through the Cornell hospitality program without necessarily having all the finance locked in and just kind of getting there and showing up and trying to figure out a way to make it work. And that was kind of a recurring theme throughout his life, was very much having an idea, committing to it, and kind of building the plane as he flew. He had an optimism to him, I found in the autobiography, and sometimes that optimism would maybe be to a fault, some would say. The example that I pulled out was the investment that he received of $65,000 by Harvey Fruhauf, in Burger King, and instead of and in hindsight, he referenced in the book, probably should have paid down some of the debt with that capital, but he plowed it into development, and obviously it paid off. How did you guys see that kind of optimism up close? How did that kind of infect your lives, and was that a recurring theme that you saw in your father and your grandfather's life?
I totally believe he was an optimist at heart in every facet he could live in. The interesting story about Harvey Fruhauf. Harvey Fruhauf was a patient of my grandfather. My grandfather was E. Sterling Nichol, founded or co-founded the Miami Heart Institute, and he was a cardiologist. And Harvey was seeing him and happened to be at a cocktail party at my grandfather's home when he met my dad. And they talked business. Harvey was the founder of Fruhauf Truck Lines, so they built trailers for semis back in the 40s and 50s and 60s. I think they're still building them today, but not with Harvey's involvement. But at any rate, so Harvey was a wealthy man, and he basically was convinced by my father to invest $65,000 to buy 50% of their company. That's a hell of a buy when you look at, you know, 15 years later or something, they sold it for $16 million. So he got $8 million for his $65,000 investment. But they also had a great working relationship too. Harvey was a great businessman, taught him a lot about how to manage the balance sheet was critical. And he enjoyed dealing with Harvey all along the way. At any rate, yeah, he was an optimist. He totally cared about looking at the bright side of every endeavor he took on, whether it was in business or pleasure or philanthropy.
I think every entrepreneur has a bit of optimism to him, and he's the epitome of that. You want to go into the hamburger business and you dream to sell hamburgers across the United States and get in a race with Ray Kroc and beat him. You got to be pretty optimistic. You're going to take $65,000 and to heck with paying off debt. We're going to build more stores. None of them are profitable. Let's build more. You got to be pretty optimistic, you know. More is the answer to make money. And you see that in everything, and his philanthropy later, and in the Miami Dolphin investment as well. You know, the city needed the team. Let's keep the team around. Fairchild Tropical Gardens, it needed a massive rework after Andrew. Let's, you know. put in the work and rebuild the garden. Let's raise the most money any university in history has ever raised. And he did that for the University of Miami. So everything that he touched, he did it big, and optimism is kind of the secret sauce there. So you got to be optimistic to and dream big to do big things.
Sterling,
And
I
have
want to
faith in
jump.
yourself.
Oh, that's a great point. Thank you, Whit. I want to jump exactly on what you just said, Sterling, which is this almost Swiss Army knife approach of James McLemore. The idea that he goes to Cornell, studies hospitality, wants to get in the restaurant business, does it, and then sees the opportunity of the quick service, self-service drive-in that becomes Burger King and that industry sector, which basically leads, the restaurant market for the rest of the century. But in developing out Burger King, he and his partner David Edgerton, who were both key in making Burger King what it becomes, they had to very quickly pivot into a variety of other businesses, managing inventory, shipment of that inventory, manufacturing of new methods of cooking. Once the initial plan they had of the Insta Burger King from the franchise in Jacksonville was proved to kind of be a mess. And it seems at every single step, James and David are nimble and they're able to adapt. And I think Whit, you use the term businessman. So much of I think modern business is characterized by specialization. Your father and your grandfather was not a specialist. He was a broad-based thinker, and we see that through his philanthropy, which we'll get into in a minute. But my question was, why do you think they were able to pivot so nimbly and face these incredible early challenges and ultimately plow through? What do you think was the what I think you used the term the secret sauce? What do you think was their secret sauce in being able to adapt to these new industries and really conquer them?
Well, I think clearly his Cornell education is part of that. I too went to the hotel school at Cornell, and I can't attest to what my dad's class schedule was like, but I took meat science, I took food chemistry, I took accounting, I was a teaching assistant for two different classes, one effective communications for speech writing and things like that, and also drafting. So you're learning all facets of the business world related to the hospitality industry. That gave him the basic knowledge to take any situation that came up and say, here's how we're going to have to tackle this. You got to imagine back in 1955 or 6 or 7, there was no business you could call and order all of your equipment delivered to the site. They had to create the equipment. They had specialized stainless steel equipment for steamers, for the Whopper board, the burger board. Special shake machines, all that kind of stuff. So they had to reinvent the wheel in terms of creating their business called Davmore, which was the equipment manufacturing business, and Distron, which was the commissary business that put together all of the napkins, straws, cups, plates. I remember going to Distron, and they had this vat that was approximately 15 feet round that had tons of meat thrown in with the fat, and it was grinding it up and pounding it out into hamburger patties. And that was delivered fresh every day to the restaurant. So it was pretty impressive when you think about this small little company that started up in Miami in the 50s and how it became what it is today. It all started with the gumption that they can do anything they want. They just got to do it right and at a price that makes it effective. One of the things that Dad always was proud to have in his office was a sign that said, something to the effect of, this is a profit-making organization. That's the way we intended it, and that's the way it will be. So they wanted all their franchisees to believe that they could take this business and make a profit and have a successful life.
I think it goes beyond Cornell because I'm not a Cornell graduate, but I am a member of the family. And I think it's just built into our entrepreneurial spirit and back to the optimism. It's a something just I don't know if it's just in our family or just a part of more so just the thought that you can do something if you put your mind to it and you have hard work, the ability to take a step back and see the problem. And I think that my grandfather was good at that. It's like, okay, we need to build restaurants. We need to build them fast. So if I can't get the construction materials quickly, then we're going to create a company to do it. And he and Dave were a great pairing. He was a great financial mind, and Dave was a great builder. He built the broiler because the instant broiler sucked. Dave sunk the hatchet into it and killed the business. And, Jim was like, well, Davey, you better get going. And they went up and he designed a better product. And then they built a company, wrapped a company around it. And that's kind of the neat thing about Burger King is all these untold stories of the massive companies that they built behind the scenes. Each and every one of the companies that they built behind Burger King are massive successes in and of their own. Like if you had, if you had just built the Distron company itself, wow, what a hit. You could hang your hat on that alone. But they were doing this as a side project. It's pretty impressive. And they never stopped. They're a ball in motion stays in motion, and they were in motion. They were moving. They were just thinking of these things to keep their franchisees happy, to keep them successful. It was just everyone was working towards a common goal. And he was just a very good, broad thinker and a good strategist on how to achieve the common goal of a winning. You can almost take the Don. I listened to your podcast about the Don Shula winning edge, and I think that was Burger King winning edge of just focusing and keeping your eye on the target.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Well, one, thank you for listening. And two, I will tell you, the book is fantastic as a whole product. But I think it's in chapter 5 or 6 when Dave goes after the Insta broiler. I think that like page, 2 pages is like some of the best autobiographical writing I've read in a long time. It's very, you really feel like you're there. Just the details of, I won't spoil everything about it because I really do want folks to get the book. But just the drawing of the axe with Dave's childhood nickname on the handle. Just that little nugget there was like, ah, this is great. I really feel like I'm there. And just the, again, to both of their credit, their ingenuity, of putting together, was a real like kind of nightmare situation in the moment. Their ability to kind of put everything back together. And like you said, Sterling, build businesses off of businesses, where if you're just, making one, like tip your hat, you're getting your name on something somewhere. They're building businesses to support their main business and crushing that too. And so you had mentioned, I believe, Whit, you mentioned the purchase of the Dolphins. And we see as we get into the late 60s, early 70s, that James McLemore is pivoting a bit in his responsibilities to the community. And that Dolphins one is a big one. We did do an episode on the Dolphins. We've done a couple actually, including their foundation, their formation, with Joe Robbie and Danny Thomas. But what a lot of folks don't know is that that partnership wasn't long for this world. And Joe Robbie was having difficulty kind of keeping the ship steering as the Dolphins were being brought into the NFL. And your dad played a pivotal role, Whit, and your grandfather Sterling played a pivotal role in keeping the Dolphins in town. I'm just curious, was your father much of a sports fan? Or was this more of a community philanthropic kind of view, or a little bit A, a little bit of B?
I know one of the things Dad used to like to say was that he was the best third string quarterback Cornell Bears ever had. So he loves football. He was a scratch golfer. So he always considered himself an athlete. And he was very proud to get involved with the Dolphins. I think he is one of six or seven guys that invested with Robbie to buy a part of the team. They minor investors, but they still got a part of the team. Don Shula also got to buy into that club as well, and that made him very successful financially as well. but he always considered himself an athlete, to answer your question.
That's
But
interesting. I
I
had no
think
idea. So
he did it for the community more so than anything, right, Dad? That was always my understanding was he did not want
he
Miami to lose
definitely wanted to keep
money.
the Dolphins at and Miami. Miami was important to keep that team there.
Yeah, especially after the loss of the Seahawks in the 40s, Miami was kind of seen as a not a pro level town. And if the Dolphins had left 3 years in, it probably would have, really kind of driven the nail through professional sports down here for a while. So any sports fan down here kind of has a debt of gratitude to appreciate. So your father did well on the Dolphins, invested, kept them in town, two Super Bowls in a short period of time, which is great. And speaking of 1972, the big year for the Dolphins, it's also a big year for James McLemore because he retires from Burger King and kind of goes into retirement and talks about this in the book too. Goes into retirement at an early age and definitely does not see himself as even though he was a great golfer, as the only playing golf type going to retirement. He has an entire second life really centered around philanthropy. Philanthropy, Sterling, you mentioned it. Philanthropy po focused on the University of Miami. Philanthropy, hard word to say, focused on Fairchild Gardens because of his incredible love of tropical gardening in particular. Of all the things in this significant period of time, we're talking 72 into the 90s, what do you think are a few that and they may be the ones that you mentioned earlier and that I just mentioned, but what are the things that really stand out to you as like the biggest, most special achievements of James McLemore?
Dad, do you want to
Well, in
start
my
and have
opinion,
me wrap up?
clearly his involvement with the University of Miami is was m his most proud moment, I think. At the time when he got on the board, he was on the board for several years before he became chairman of the board. But when he became chairman of the board and they were instrumental in hiring Tad Foote as the incoming president of the university, Tad and he discussed many times what they could do to increase the endowment of the university. And from what I understand, back in the day, no university had ever tried to raise $400 million in a campaign. But in their 5-year campaign to raise $400 million, they were so successful, they raised $517.5 million in that 5-year period. So clearly, other universities, Cornell included, took note, and now they're doing billion-dollar campaigns because there's a lot of money out there that people want to give back to their universities. And they were very successful in studying the people in Miami and outside of Miami that wanted to be a part of that organization's effort. So they were really, really good at analyzing the donor potential and going after them and saying, "Hey, we need your help. Here's what we can do. What can we do to help you spread your family's fame?" And a lot of that was naming buildings on campus, off campus. They did a lot of really great things during that effort. So that was this one main thing. I think getting Fairchild Garden back was another. He was on the board, but not chairman. But after Andrew, he became chairman. And he went to the board meeting right after that. And he said, "Well, guys, we need to raise a bunch of money. And I'm proposing a $5 million campaign. And by the way, I've already got $1 million." So they were like, "What?" They'd never raised $1 million before in their campaign. So they were shocked, and his involvement was really critical in turning that place around.
Yeah, that's fantastic. As a I majored in economics at UM as well as broadcast journalism, and so I saw the name Macklemore plenty on campus thanks to his contributions to the school and to the business center. The executive education center there is really top notch.
But I wanted to circle back, if we
Sure.
can, to life after 1972, because there's a second chapter of my grandfather's life that is almost equal to his first chapter. And I don't think that, people who found a company like Burger King, they usually hang it up there and they'll have a foundation. Just for they'll start like a family foundation, like the Macklemore Family Foundation, just for posterity purposes or to divest wealth. That wasn't my grandfather at all. He stayed very active in his he had a full-time job after retiring. He stayed on a lot of boards, so he was active in the business community. But his role at University of Miami as chairman, as you heard, he raised the largest campaign out of anyone at the time. No one had ever done it. He kind of got laughed out of the room that they were going to raise 400 million, and he crushed it by over 117 million. There's the optimism you referred to earlier. There's the killer instinct that he had, and the Fairchild Tropical Gardens, the same thing, saving the city of Miami. When he moved from New York, he was all in on Miami. He loved the city. He did everything he could for the city in his time there. He didn't spend, although he gave money to Cornell, he adopted Miami. That was his town. He did a lot. He loved the town. As a Cornell grad, he was chairman of the board of University of Miami, and he didn't buy the New York Jets or Giants or whatever. He was a Dolphin, and he cared so much about the city of Miami and making sure that it was the greatest place to be because he loved it so much. I think if you asked him at the, and I asked Dad this question and my mom too, if you asked him at the end of his life, what was his greatest achievement? Was it the philanthropic work that he did? Or was it Burger King? And they both had a really hard time answering that question. I don't know. We don't know the answer to that question. And that says a lot about the man. That's how much he really cared about what he did after Burger King. He loved giving back. The scholarship he got at Cornell defined him for his entire life. From that professor, that was who he is, and that he was, forever grateful, and that forever changed him, right, Dad? I mean, that you can see that single moment just really, he wanted to give back because of the opportunity that he got. And that's our directive at the foundation. It's part of our mission, and that's what we still do because that's what he wants us to do. Still.
So, we have this kind of champion of the community, titan of industry that retires and focuses that energy on community betterment. And he decides in the early to mid 1990s to write about his life experiences and to produce an autobiography, as we've referenced before. The Burger King, which has been reissued by the Macklemore Family Foundation through Mango Publishing. Again, I encourage folks to go and pick it up, ebook, physical copy, all that stuff. We always love for folks to go to Books and Books if you're down here in Dade County. But so he finishes this book months before his death in 1996. And I know that Sterling, you had some work to do with this book. And I know Whit, you're obviously familiar with it as well. You lived it, for goodness sake. What do you think motivated him to produce this, and what motivated you guys to do the reissuance in 2020?
Dad loved reading biographies. He read, I don't even know how many biographies, but over 100 different biographies. So he thought it was important to get his story down as best he could in his own voice. And that's what I love about his book, is it's written like he's speaking to you as a friend. And it really reads that way too. It's just a really well-written book, in my opinion. But he loved biographies, and that's why I think he wanted to do it. He thought he had something worth saying, and he was committed to doing it. I just wish he could have seen it published, because he did
Yeah.
pass away before we got it published.
Yeah, and our foundation reissued it just because our cousin Tucker, who's the secretary of the foundation, has a little bit to do with book publishing and had worked with Mango. We thought we could clean it up and also do an audiobook version of it, which hadn't been done yet. So we wanted to get it back out there and kind of reissue it. We thought it was a good story. It didn't have a lot of traction in the beginning. I think the first issuance was a little harder to read. So the second issuance cut some of the pages out and cleaned up the format a little bit. So it's a little bit cleaner and easier to read on the second go round. Has a different cover with his face on it as well. So that's why we reissued it. And the proceeds go to the foundation, which helps the Burger King Foundation through the scholarship program that we have with them. So a lot of what we do is scholarships for higher education, and we're announcing with them here coming on our 20th anniversary of a scholarship program with them, a secondary education program that will do trade schools as well, because in honor of my grandmother, Nancy McLemore, she was passionate about the fact that not everybody needs a 4-year degree, that a lot of people are getting burdened by higher education debt, and that some people need, an electrician's degree or a mechanic's degree or plumber's degree and get right to work without an extreme amount of debt and have a trade that can actually make them some real money. So we're looking at that as another way to help employees of the Burger King program and also people outside the program. So it's kind of another tier in our scholarship program. So.
I know you read the book, and I appreciate that, but one of the lovely stories in that book is the fact that he went to Cornell, hitchhiked to Cornell to go start college because he'd read an article from Professor Wetzel that said that anybody can get a higher education if you just come and work towards it. So he met with Professor Wetzel and talked to him about getting into the hotel school, or rather into Cornell in general. He didn't know where he was going to go. But Professor Wetzel asked him how much money he had. He said, "Well, I have." He pulled out all the money in his pockets, and he had $11.37. And Professor Wetzel says, "I don't mean your pocket change. I mean, how much money do you have for college? Tuition's $200 here coming up soon." He goes, "Well, this is all the money I have." He goes, "You're kidding me." He goes, "No." So he got him a $50 scholarship from to the hotel school from one of the I think it was a Hilton Foundation or something. Anyway, but at the end of the day, he helped him. He got him student loans. He worked it out for him to be able to attend Cornell. And he was always thankful for that. And that's what started his whole giving back to higher education for his life. That's what he wanted to do all the time, is give back.
Yeah, you can really that story is obviously early on in the book, and it's the first example of the building the plane as you fly attitude that he had. Like, I know where I want to go and I know how to get there. I just don't necessarily have exactly what I need in front of me at this second, but by God, I'm going to figure it out. And it reappears over and over again. I will tell you that, I've had the honor of speaking with a few authors on the podcast. Or book publishers in the case of the foundation here. But it's always because I found a book and I found it interesting and I wanted to talk to the people involved. It's never Like, oh, I got to do something this month. Let's talk to someone. No, it's always, I read this book and I'm like, this is great. Like, it's really a great read. It's a quick read. In particular, the reissuance through Mango Publishing, there's a lot of interesting stuff woven in, commentary from other people that knew James, and it's just really great. It's really exceptional. And as you said, Whit, and as you hit on as well, Sterling, there's almost nothing in our community that James McLemore didn't touch. Whether it's the way we eat or the way we learn or the way we recreate in gardens, or it's everywhere. The way we spend our Sundays, it's everywhere. And so it's a pleasure to talk a little bit about James McLemore with you too. So, any final thoughts before I set you guys free today? I do appreciate your time so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us
No,
on.
thank you.
Of course. So again, we've been joined by Whit McLemore and Sterling McLemore, both of the McLemore Family Foundation. The book is The Burger King, written by their father and grandfather, respectfully, James McLemore, the co-founder of Burger King. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time and your effort.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I again want to thank Whit and Sterling McLemore for their time, for sharing their knowledge of James McLemore with me and with you. The book, as a reminder, is The Burger King, A Whopper of a Story on Life and Leadership by James W. McLemore, reissued in 2020 by local publishing house, Mango Publishing. All proceeds from the book go to support the McLemore Family Foundation, which, as you heard from Sterling, works with the Burger King Foundation to provide scholarships for those with affiliation with the Burger King Corporation, as well as other local and national high school students seeking educational opportunities. So you can get yourself a great book on an important chapter in Miami's history and do some good while doing it. So, as always, thank you, James McLemore, for his work in Miami-Dade County. Thank you to his son, Whit, his grandson, Sterling. Thank you to you, the listener, for popping in and checking this episode out. Not a lot of background resourcing on this episode because it's so much interview-driven. I will include two clips that were shared with me by Whit of James McLemore talking about some of his experiences with Burger King. You can find those clips on social media. At This Day Miami Pod, I'll be sharing them on Facebook, Blue Sky, our new text-based home. I'll also be sharing it through the X app and Instagram. So please follow there. Please make sure you follow This Day in Miami History on your preferred podcast provider. And until next time, I've been Matthew Bunch.
The high times, the low times, all in the nightlife.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.